Hi, this is Mark and Laura here from Enjoy Life Slowly. Are you too busy, too stressed, and too overwhelmed by everything you're supposed to do, be, and own? Are you so busy rushing around, connecting, consuming, competing, that you don't have time for the important things in life? Then the answer is to slow down and simplify, and in this Enjoy Life Slowly interview series, you'll find out from the people who know exactly how to get your life back in control. These interviews were conducted in the field, and the quality of the conversation may be better than the quality of the audio. Hi everybody, this is Mark from Enjoy Life Slowly, and today I'm chatting with Ram. Now, one thing I must say is that your site is, we were just talking about that before we started the interview, very, very individual. I must say, to me, it strikes me as really, it's kind of more like a philosophy site, one of the sort of old school philosophy sites. I could imagine you do very well in old ancient Greek times, something like that. You know, that's that kind of thing. So I'm intrigued about a great many things on the site and the way you do stuff. I want to start with the description. You say you're a generalist in life and a specialist in action. What does that actually mean, and what does that look like in every day?
First, Mark, I want to say thanks for having me on. And yeah. I'd say that a generalist in life, specialist in action, that's something that I made up, I guess you could say, when I started to think about the word generalist, because I consider myself very much a generalist, very much someone who dabbles in a little bit of everything. I'm interested in pretty much everything. But at the same time, when I am learning something or when I am doing something, I take a very focused approach to it. So okay. I would say generalist in life means be ready for anything. Specialist in action means that when you're doing something, do it with intention, do it with focus, do it with intent. And that's something that I try to live because I'm so interested in so many things, it makes it very challenging to actually focus on one particular thing. But I've learned, mostly through trial and error, that it's impossible to do everything at once. So I do have to focus on, you know, at least one thing at a time, because in reality, our brains only focus on one thing at a time. They may multitask by switching back and forth really quick, but in reality, they do one thing at a time. So I'd say specialist in action means that, means focusing on one thing at a time.
I absolutely agree with you. Actually, I was just reading Leo's post, Zen Habits, his latest post, yep. And he was just saying kind of exactly the same thing. You know, it's all very well writing massive to-do lists with all these things on it, but you can't really do more than one thing at a time anyway well. You know, you might have a lot of projects on the go, but you've got to concentrate on the one thing at a time, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's if you don't focus on one thing, you not only don't do it well, but you also end up just not accomplishing a whole lot overall.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I was reading, do you know a chap, I saw came across his book recently, Essentialism by Greg McKeown?
No, I haven't.
He was saying that until sort of this century, the word priority had no plural. if you look back, he was saying it was basically used in the singular, and it's over this century that it's come up that you have all these priorities. And his point in his book Essentialism is that really you can only have one priority at a time.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Now, you say on your site, I must say, I was going to ask you another question, but one thing struck me also, I did want to ask you. On your site, you say self-sufficiency leads to empathy. That kind of seems to be your tagline, yeah?
Well, that's actually just one of my – I published just short thoughts like that on my site, and that's just the latest one that I came up with. I just published that yesterday, I believe.
Cool, yeah.
It was just something – it was just something I had been thinking about what was I thinking? I was thinking about something related to self-sufficiency and self-reliance, and I was thinking about how that actually, if you're self-sufficient, you're required to do all the things that everybody else might do for you.
Right.
If you're willing to make your own clothes, build your own house, you know, gather your own food, and as a result, you automatically empathize with all the people who have to do that on a day-to-day basis.
Okay,
and that, you know, so I was just realizing that self-sufficiency fosters empathy.
Brilliant. Okay, that explains it. I was looking at it and I was going, I'm sure I can work that out. But now you say it, I absolutely agree. We used to do a lot of traveling by bike across various countries. And with that, especially when you got sort of further afield to parts of Asia and stuff, when we used to do it, you know, you had to do everything yourself. You had to find food and you had to find somewhere to stay for the night. We didn't know the language. Some places weren't so friendly at the time, a lot of communist countries. And it did foster, now you say, a huge empathy for the people who were there, who had to do all that stuff for themselves anyway. And we were just, in some ways, we were just kind of had the luxury, even though we had to do it.
Right.
We were there because we wanted to be, and they had, like, no choice in it. So I can agree with you a lot there.
Awesome. Yeah, I was just, it was something I was thinking about yesterday, and I realized it definitely sounded like a true thought. And often when I have those true thoughts or those things that I come across where I suddenly realize that, that just sounds very, very true, very real. I often just jot those things down and then I publish them as, you know, one or two sentence. I call them thoughts, but they're just little posts on my site.
Well, I mean, that's excellent. Like I say, that caught my eye straight away. I was mentioning also before this that, you know, on your site, you obviously do a lot of thinking as well as an awful lot of writing. I mean, you're very prolific. And do you actually consider yourself a philosopher? I know you mentioned that. Is there a certain way you look at everything in life that you would call a philosophy?
I would say that I definitely think deeply about life, about meaning, about purpose. Whether or not I would call myself a philosopher, I would say that I'd say the best way to explain my answer to that question would be. When I thought about publishing things on my site and labeling them as poetry, and I realized I was looking, because I'm so interested in writing and so, you know, I treat words very carefully. So I'm constantly looking up the definitions for words and understanding intricacies between them and understanding how little words differ and things like that. And I realized that if you call something poetry, that's like calling something beautiful. So it's like saying that this piece of art that I just created, it's beautiful. You as the artist, you can say that, but does that carry nearly as much meaning as, say, a room full of people calling your art beautiful? I mean, it's an entirely different thing. So the same thing with poetry. If I call my writing poetry, that's sort of egotistical. You know, that's sort of saying that I think this is poetry, so therefore everybody else should. Whereas if I simply call this a poem, that's indicating it's a type of writing that has the poetry form.
Okay.
Then everybody else can choose whether or not to call it poetry. So in the same way, I wouldn't call myself a philosopher. If everybody else thinks that I'm a philosopher because of the stuff that I write, that's fine. But I'm not going to label myself a philosopher. I will say that I definitely think along the lines of, you know, philosophical terms. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I mean, I think my dad told me when I was probably 4 or 5 is when I started asking the question, like, you know, if we all eventually die one day, I think I had just been told, you know, that everything and everyone eventually dies. I asked, well, if everyone dies, what's the purpose of living? You know, like what's the point of living if everything is eventually going to die no matter what? So from then on, I started having these like really introspective thoughts, and ever since then, I mean, basically for as long as I can remember, I've always looked at everything and asked, you know, what's its purpose, where's it going, where's it from, things like that.
Well, we're actually in France at the moment, and most of my family are actually French, and they've got a very different view to philosophy. It's, I mean, you know, we live in the UK, and I don't know if it's much the same in America. In some ways, philosophy's kind of it's not really considered mainstream, and it's also considered kind of a little bit esoteric. Whereas in France, it's not really like that. I mean, the Prime Minister has his own philosopher, who's a bit of a celebrity here.
Right.
You know, it's a very different way of looking at things.
Huh? Yeah, I did not realize there was that difference.
Yeah, it's kind of, philosophy is a much more mainstream thing here. Not that everybody necessarily reads it or understands it.
Right.
If you call yourself a philosopher, people don't really bat an eyelid too much.
Interesting.
Do you think, because I know I read a little bit about it, the unconventional aspects to your childhood, you know, you were homeschooled, raised as a vegetarian, and you started your first business at the age of 16, which is quite amazing. Do you think those had influences from, you know, the way you look at life now, including your philosophies?
Absolutely. I definitely think so. I think that I'd say, I mean, it's hard to pinpoint any one thing, but I'd say that being homeschooled and having as much freedom as I did to explore the things that interested me and and just sort of guide myself in different directions. I still had plenty of guidance from my parents who were homeschooling me, but at the same time, they gave me a lot of freedom to say, oh, you know, you want to spend an extra 2 or 3 hours going through that science book? Go for it. Because I had always gravitated towards science more than anything else. So my dad is actually a writer by trade.
Okay.
He was a technical writer. He hasn't done very much like creative writing and things like that. He has done plenty of it, but not a whole lot of it's published. But he did work as a technical writer, basically writing technical manuals and things like that for big corporations when I was growing up. So I got exposed to a lot of his writing, and he did a lot of he did publish like a small newsletter that he sent out to a group of people. So he would help, you know, he would have me he would have me proofread a lot of his stuff just as a way of like helping me catch errors that he didn't catch. And then he would go back and he'd show me which things I missed and things like that. So absolutely. I mean, plenty from my childhood definitely had a huge influence on who I am now and where I am.
That's excellent. It's very different, isn't it, with people, because some people like yourself, you know, you've sort of got a background in your upbringing in writing, and you kind of you carry that on with you. I mean, for myself, I don't think I ever saw a book in my household while I was growing up. And yet at the age of 16, I was reading Goethe and trying to read philosophy and stuff like that. I didn't understand a word of it. I was only 16, but I was drawn to it. But it's weird, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, people are sort of seem to be products of their upbringing. Sometimes it seems to be the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems sometimes their upbringing channels them in a direction that had nothing to do with their upbringing, or you know, their upbringing somehow redirected their focus in life in a way that you would never have guessed was going to happen given the circumstances of their life. Absolutely.
So do you, as you say, did you have in about 2009, I think that was when you sort of started doing the digital nomad life properly?
Correct, yep.
So was that like a complete switch from what you were doing before, or was there some elements of that in your, you know, upbringing or your past, or was it a complete break?
No, it was definitely a complete break. I mean, I had no influence in my childhood that I can think of that that would have pushed me towards digital nomadism or becoming a nomad or even getting rid of all of my things. I mean, that my parents, I grew up in a house that was kept very simple. You know, we didn't have furniture. We didn't have a television. You know, things were very simple. But as I got older, I mean, there was plenty of stuff around. I mean, we slowly started to get things that when I was a teenager, you know, they got a couch in the house. I grew up without a bed.
We all
slept on the floor.
Was that a cultural thing?
Yeah. I think it was influenced by, I mean, my parents followed the Hindu religion. It was more Vedic religion,
okay.
Vedic, which is ancient Sanskrit teachings that basically Hinduism is derived from. But basically, they followed a lot of that, so they were very much inspired by that and made certain life choices of their own, which, you know, they also were not brought up like this at all. These were conscious choices they made as young adults when they got married and before I was even born. You know, that they were going to raise their family in this way. So I grew up in a very minimalist household in terms of possessions and things like that. But we had a good sized house. I mean, it was not a tiny house. We had a huge yard. You know, I had access to plenty of stuff. And then as I got older, they started to accumulate more things, and they eventually got a couch and a bed and TV and things like that. So, I mean, I'd say the thing that instigated my digital nomad journey was in my early 20s, just after I turned 20, actually, in 2001. Just after I turned 20 in 2001, I invested in a multifamily property with some rental units in it, with the intention of building up an investment.
Yeah.
And I had always, even as a child, I had wanted to travel the world. I mean, that was something that I don't know how that idea got in my head, but traveling the world with a backpack was something that I wanted to do since I was a teenager, a young teenager.
It's funny how they Sorry, I was going to say it's funny how these things come to you. Ever since I was about 16, I'd never been abroad, and I just used to pull out an atlas, and I drew a line from London to the other side of the world, and that's all I ever wanted to do, was travel across the world on that line. And I've no idea why. Nobody in my family ever traveled.
I had the same fascination with maps and globes. I could never get enough of looking at an actual, you know, like a nicely drawn globe. It was just something I could marvel at for hours. I got into real estate investment knowing that it was going to hold me down, but doing it because at the time, my understanding of what it took to travel the world was that it took a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, it took a lot of resources, a lot of wealth, because that was the only image I had in my head. That was the only thing that people around me had told me was, oh, you got to have a lot of money to do that. So I had no other perspective that it was even possible without a lot of money. So I thought, okay, you know, I'll start investing in these properties in my early 20s. I actually ended up over the course of the 3 years. I bought the first one when I was 21 and then two more after that. And I thought to myself, I'll hold on to these. Everyone said it was an excellent investment, very good. I was going to be set for life and this and that. And I did it clearly with the goal in mind of when I'm 30 or 40 years old, I'll sell all of them and then just start traveling the world.
Okay.
Like, it was the only reason I did it was because I knew that was eventually going to let me get to where I want to be, which was with nothing and just traveling the world.
Yeah.
And then by chance in 2007, 2008, there was the subprime mortgage crisis in the United States, that eventually affected the rest of the world as well. And I ended up losing two of the properties to foreclosure and selling one of them at a short sale. So I sold it for like half the amount that was owed, and ended up filing for bankruptcy because that's just what you do after that kind of stuff happens here. And then after that, that was sort of the thing that started the process going of getting rid of things, because owning those three properties, renting to 12 different tenants. I had 12 different units that I was renting. I was doing all the maintenance on it. So it was a very stressful, time-consuming thing. And I didn't like that. I didn't like how much stress that had on my, put on my shoulders from a day-to-day basis. And then when I got rid of them, not by choice, but because I was more or less forced to, it felt so good to be rid of that, to have that off my shoulders, to be free of it. And I started to ask myself, well, what else can I be free of? What other things are in my life that I'm not actually that don't actually need to be there, that I can let go of, that I can sell or donate or whatever? So I started doing that. That was 2009. And in 2009, I started, out of curiosity, just searching the internet for other people who might be traveling the world cheaply. And I started discovering all these other people who were blogging about it that had essentially packed a backpack and started traveling, to different countries where the currency difference, another thing that I hadn't really thought of, when I was younger, because I never really had any exposure to that. You know, the currency difference being you could have $1,500 here and you could survive on that in another country for months. So in 2009, I made the decision that I was going to quit my job at the time, no matter how much money I had left, and finish selling what I had and essentially pack a single bag, and that's what I did. Beginning of 2010, I left with a single round-trip ticket to India with six months in between and about $2,000 in my bank account.
That was a pretty brave decision.
Yeah, it was. I still find it now, looking back at it, surprising that I was able to do it.
So what would you say you gained most from making that change?
Oh, wow. A lot. I mean, it's essentially redirected my entire life. Like, I feel like life post 2009 is not even the same life pre 2009. I mean, it just in every way possible, it changed. But it changed me in terms of, like, I had a much more career minded focus, a much more money-minded focus, like thinking in terms of how much money do I need, a much more egotistical or personal focus. Like, it was more about me and not so much about how what I do and what choices I make affect everybody else around me. And after going to India and living on $250 a month, which was a very small budget, but I was living comfortably. I was staying in hotels. I was I mean, they were really cheap hotels, but they're still hotels. And I was still living rich compared to most of the people around me. And that, you know, that had a pretty big impact on my perception of wealth and of what kinds of things are necessary. And it made me think a lot about, because I work entirely online. I was able to get some freelance work online while I was over there. So it made me think a lot about, well, what does it mean to be someone in the modern world who can do all these things with a laptop and travel anywhere they want in the world? What does it mean to be that person, and how does that person's actions and that person's choices affect the billions of people who do not have that option?
When you actually started the digital nomad life, I was just saying that I think to most people, it's kind of like that dream idea to be location independent and be able to travel where you want, when you want. But when you actually, you know, you did the reality of actually going out and becoming a digital nomad, was there something that sort of challenged your original perception of how it was going to look, how it was going to pan out?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd say more than anything, it was definitely the amount of time that I needed to be online in front of a screen, not able to be outside swimming in the ocean or hiking up a mountain or going exploring the city. And, you know, so, I mean, as it is now, I probably work 50, 60 hours a week, and all that time is spent entirely in front of a computer. No matter how nice it is outside, no matter where I am, and you know, it's really difficult to take a lot of that time off and still fulfill the various business responsibilities that I have now with running my own business. So I'd say more than anything, it's the amount of time that is required to be online. And I mean, there are times when I honestly wish that I did not know as much as I know about technology and computers and things like that, because I wish I could just work as, like, I don't know, just maybe a landscaper outside for a landscaping company or building houses outside, you know, just something that gets me outside where I can experience the changes in the weather and feel the breeze and feel the sun and things like that. I mean, I've tried various things like working outside with a laptop. That doesn't work too well. No. You know, just various things like that. And I mean, the compromise I've sort of reached is I never allow myself to work more than 3 hours at a time in one sitting. I always get up and change locations. If that means moving from, you know, my hotel room or the hostel where I'm staying to a cafe down the street or just something, just go somewhere else. And that ensures that I at least get to, you know, get outside, move around, do things. And then I'm pretty good now after several years of doing this, of forcing myself to get offline for, you know, at least one.
Hello? Hello.
Unappealing, I guess.
Brilliant. Sorry, I lost you. You just, the last bit broke up there, but don't worry about
it.
Okay. That's okay. Sorry, hence the pause there. I want to ask you something else as well. Laura and I are passionate about simplifying and minimalizing. And I know that's something, obviously, you're very interested in, and something that with your digital nomad life, it's kind of quite essential. But I just want to say, I actually read your thought or piece on crayons, and I thought that was a really interesting piece, because I hadn't really considered how many decisions or how you need to work out how to be a minimalist, a digital nomad, and a dad all at the same time. That must make it quite hard sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, hence the reason I have not written very much about it on my site. I'm still trying to figure out what my thoughts are on it before I can even, you know, write about what my thoughts are. I mean, the crazy thing is, you know, I mean, everyone says children grow up so fast, but until you're an actual parent, it's really hard to comprehend what it truly means with how fast they grow up.
Yeah.
I take it on a day-to-day basis, and I try to think about how convey or pass along my thoughts on lessons that I've learned, and try to create an environment or create a world for my daughter Ananda. I try to create of the world that I have learned is a better world than, say, the world I currently see.
Which is quite hard, isn't it? It's
absolutely very hard because it's constantly an uphill battle. You're constantly fighting against or looking out for or navigating around all these other things that she's going to be exposed to. And, you know, I also have to accept that I can't control everything in her life. You know, she is her own person. She's going to, you know, be exposed to things that I will, you know, have absolutely no control over, over her seeing or experiencing. And all I can really do, and this is sort of something I've learned from my dad, is I feel very lucky that my dad took such I don't want to say hands-off approach because it wasn't hands-off, but it was very much he gave me the tools and the resources and the things that I need to decide what is the best choice.
Yeah.
So, for example, with being vegetarian, you know, I remember growing up and you know, I learned pretty quickly that being vegetarian was not the norm. It was not something that everybody did. And I clearly remember asking him, like, well, why can't I eat meat? Why can't I just try it? And, you know, he had all these various moral reasons and all these other things why it wasn't healthy and why humans were not, you know, humans don't even have the teeth for being a meat eater. Our teeth are designed for, you know, eating vegetables like cows and things like that. So he gave me all these reasons, but still being, you know, a young kid, I wanted to explore. I wanted to learn. I wanted to try and you know. And, you know, he told me, he said, look, once you turn 18, I can't stop you from doing anything. I can't stop you from drinking. I can't stop you from doing drugs, from eating meat, from doing anything, any of these things. I can't stop you. All I can do right now is tell you what I feel is the best thing based on what I've learned. And then when you get to that age, I can hope that you make the right choice. And, you know, I did after I got, you know, after I was like 19, 20, I did. I tried meat. I was curious. But I eventually, you know, discovered on my own that it was not something I wanted to continue doing. And no doubt in part due to the lessons that my dad taught me, you know, but I had to learn those things on my own. So the same way, I mean, for me teaching Ananda, I just feel like I have to set an example for her. I have to live the life that I want her to learn from. And that's the most important thing is you have to set the example for others around you. You can't just preach it and talk it and write about it and things like that. If you don't actually live it yourself, then what's the point?
True, completely. I absolutely agree. I was going to say as well, with your writing, is it something that you started doing because of exactly what you said, that you wanted to put out this example of what you think perhaps is right or what you think would be a good way for things to be done in the world? Or was it something more that actually just came out of the desire that you wanted to create your digital nomad life? Sort of which came first?
Definitely the writing came first. I mean, like I mentioned, my dad being a writer certainly encouraged me to – he didn't encourage me, but his being a writer encouraged me to write on my own and just dabble in different things. And he actually – I had mentioned the newsletter that he had published when I was younger. It was a newsletter on more Eastern philosophy and Vedic teachings and things like that. So more of like a slightly more extreme, I guess you could say, than what writing I have on my blog. A little bit more in depth and a little more a little bit harder to follow, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit harder to get to the point, maybe.
Yeah, well, a little bit harder to like digest. It was just so it was so deep. It was so – because he put a lot of thought and a lot of writing and a lot of meditation into the things that he published. And I definitely remember him inviting me to write something for the newsletter. And I remember writing something when I was probably 12 or 13. And I just – you know, I probably wrote a page or two, and then he had me edit it and everything. And I wrote – I've always had this desire to share whatever it is that I know or what I'm thinking.
And almost
in a way of documenting like a naturalist would do if they're out in the forest and they're discovering new things. They'll constantly be documenting the things that they see. That's exactly how I think about my writing and how I've always approached writing is I think of it as a record of thoughts that I've decided are true for me at this time.
So it's just curating everything.
Exactly. Curating my own thoughts and taking the curation process seriously. So it's not just a diary where I'm just rambling about things on and on and on. I take the writing itself as a craft very seriously and think of it as, how can I convey this in the most articulate way possible and make it as easy to understand as possible? And you know, and so that's always been a very strong craft that I've tried to very, very strongly to hone.
If you have the chance to start your own society, because you do think a lot. I'd say you're a great thinker. I would call you a philosopher. And I say, coming from kind of French background, you know, that's the way I'd see it. If you had a chance to start your own society, what are the main principles you'd instill in those that were a part of it? What are the main sort of things you'd put down that you go, if you're going to start a society again, this is what would have to be?
That's quite a big task. Well, I mean, I'd say that I can describe some of the principles that I would say that I would want to see in society. And if I was just press the reset button on society and have some of these values and traits instilled in the society, I would probably choose things like self-sufficiency, things like I would want I mean, I was actually thinking about this the other day. I was thinking, you know, how nice it would be if everybody was required, almost required. I mean, I don't mean required as in totalitarian required, but required as in everyone gets to spend maybe a day working as, you know, working in a different field. So, for example, I'm constantly, when I'm driving around or when I'm traveling or whatever, I see someone doing some job, and I think to myself, I wish I could just switch places with them for a day, just to see what their life is like, see what their day-to-day activities are, see what their challenges are, see what kinds of things they struggle with.
Yeah.
Because I know that would open up my mind to a whole new realm that I cannot even imagine right now. And not only that, it would make me a little bit more grateful, say, for the plumber or for the electrician or for the house builder or for, you know, the person that puts labels on the food that I go and buy at the store. I mean, all these things have actual people behind them, and there's entire lives, an entire, you know, 40, 50-hour a week work schedules that are involved in so many different things that I don't have no clue about. And if I was able to experience those if everybody was able to experience a little bit of what everyone else does, I think that we would all be a little bit nicer to each other on a day-to-day basis.
You know,
we would be a little bit more friendly with the janitor, a little bit more friendly with the bellman at the door.
I always say everyone. I was going to say, I've always said that everybody should be made one day a year to be a garbage collector.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that. That when you said that reminded me of a lot of the things, the disparity and the contrast that I saw when I was in India with just different levels of poverty and different levels of being rich, and how people in, you know, very expensive $100,000 Mercedes-Benz can drive right next to a slum where there's people that, you know, barely have anything to eat.
Yeah.
And or giant skyscrapers. I mean, I remember when I was in Bangalore. One of the first things I remember seeing there was a giant glass skyscraper, and then 10, 15, 20 feet away was a gigantic slum. Mm. And I just remember thinking, like, how does that even, like, happen in a world? Like, how does the wealth get so intentionally misdirected and not shared? And I've since learned a lot about how it got that way in terms of the caste system, and even though how that's done away with, that's still very much part of the culture and the thinking and the mindset and things like that. So I understand how it got that way, but I also see that it doesn't have to be that way. You know, it's not like there's not enough wealth to go around. It's more that there's not enough distribution of the wealth going around and enough people that are willing to live within their means and not live above their means unnecessarily. So, I mean, I'd say that for me in society is the type of thing that I would want to instill, or I'd want to try to build into society, is some way of ensuring that people
remain empathetic and remain able to relate to everybody in society. Because in the end, we're all living on this planet together. You know, we're all breathing the same air. We're all drinking the same water. All the resources everybody's using. There's no one that's using, using air from Mars or using, you know, food from some other planet or whatever. It's all right here on Earth on this one little rock floating in space that, you know, we all have to share. And I think that's not on a day-to-day basis. That's not felt at all. You know, people do not feel that. And there's various reasons they don't feel that. I mean, it's not necessarily their fault that they don't feel it, but it's just that's society and has built in certain things that make that relationship to the world very difficult to foster. I often just look up when the sky is dark at night and you can see all the stars. I look up and I just think about – I try to imagine myself standing on a rock floating in space. And that really gives me the sensation that, you know, I'm really here with everybody else. Like every other person on this planet is right here with me in this little tiny speck of space floating around the giant universe. It's a humbling experience. And I think that kind of thing needs to be done on a regular basis by everybody to try to get a sense of where we are together.
Completely. Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that. I mean, you know, everybody is just here and it really makes no difference where you are. There was a good example of that in a small way here in France. There's the farmers here have been having some problems with, getting sufficient price for their milk. The actual food industry pays them less for their milk than it costs them to produce. So the farmers are daily going bankrupt. But at the same time, they're kind of blockading stuff to stop British farmers sending milk here. And it's this whole thing that they're all just farmers. You know, if they could just see that there's no difference between whether you're an English farmer or a French farmer or an African farmer, it's all the same thing. Yep. You know, if you could just
– absolutely.
As you say, look down and go, you know, whether you're the garbage collector or you're the farmer or you're the guy who's, you know, running a giant business, there's really no difference. It's all, as you say, it's all one place, isn't it?
Mm. And I think that, I mean, I am a very optimistic person at heart, and I definitely see the positive things that are going for the world in terms of resolving those issues. You know, we look at how something like the internet has bridged so many gaps that previously were impossible to bridge. I mean, look at us right now. We're talking thousands of miles away across an entire ocean that, you know, previously would have taken weeks to get across on a boat. And now we're just able to, you know, press a few buttons and have this conversation. And then you're going to share this and, you know, other people will be able to hear us at some point in the future from wherever they are in the world. I mean, that's such an empowering thing that connects us all. So I do see the internet as something that is going to change a lot of that and improve it. But there's still plenty of old systems in place. I mean, like you were just saying with the farmers, a lot of that is related to governments having certain ways of doing things that you know, if there was, I mean, I'm not proposing this is what needs to happen now. Right. It's unrealistic. But if there was a single government where it was, you know, the government of Earth, where everybody had to say, okay, well, we're going to manufacture milk. Well, where does the milk need to go? It needs to go over here. It needs to cost this much. That these people, I mean, that's the way it should work in reality. I mean, the reality is that there are governments and there are groups of people who want to stick together and things like that. And that's all part of the journey. But I do see hope, I guess you could say, for the future. I do see things getting much better before they get worse.
Definitely. I mean, I'm absolutely optimistic as well. People are fantastic. At the end of the day, you know, people really are marvelous. The trouble is that the few who aren't are the ones who make the news. But that's not the average person. The average person is excellent. I used to work for Oxfam and Barnardo's, which is a UK children's charity. And, you know, having travelled a lot of the world on bicycle and a long time ago, a lot of it, like when it was communist and it was very difficult to get around. All that we ever came across was helpful people in all countries. I think if you say the one defining thing, I think that everybody has across the world is that fact they are so helpful and compassionate to other people when they're in
trouble. And that will never make the news.
No. So
never make the news.
So I've kept you for ages here and a few technical problems. I just want to ask you one last thing, Ram. You covered so many things on your site through your own observation experiences. But out of all the things on your site, if someone comes to your site, what do you really hope they take away? What is, if they could just take away one thing from the site, which I know is quite a big question because there's so much there.
I'd say I would hope that that people take away that people think slightly more introspectively about things, that they slow down and just reflect on whatever it is around them or whatever it is that's going on in their life. I often, anytime a friend or a loved one or someone has some big issue that they're dealing with, I always try to explain that, you know, in the nicest way possible, that any issue that we have, no matter how terrible it can be, is really just a very small thing in the bigger picture. I mean, in the moment, it feels big, and I'm not saying things are not important, but I'm saying that the bigger picture is very big, and we are so insignificantly small. If you not only take, I mean, often people think about the size of the galaxy as like a giant room, like that's they think in spatial terms.
Yeah.
But what's often forgotten is there's a whole other dimension of time. Of, you know, it's not just the spatial the amount of space in the universe, but it's also the amount of time in the universe. You know, we're living in the smallest sliver, such a small sliver. Like our entire existence is going to be in such a small sliver that it's just a blip. And you know, all these things, they come and they go, and you know, bad things happen and good things happen and people are born and people die and people get married and so on and so forth. I mean, all these things happen. And I guess if someone came to my site and they read a few things, my hope would be that they read something that makes them pause in whatever busyness they have in their life, whatever, you know, complexities their life holds, and they just, you know, reflect a little bit more than they otherwise would. I mean, that's what I hope that people get from something that I share, is that they become a little slightly more introspective, and that they reflect a little bit.
Well, I've got to tell you that I'm pretty sure you're achieving your aim. Definitely. If you can't read anything on your site, it does have that effect. You know, absolutely.
That's great.
So you're in a winning with that. So thanks very much, Ram. That's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you, Mark.
Obviously, the site is Ram. That's double AM, isn't it?
Yes, .org, two A's. Correct.
Which is a fantastic site. You should definitely go and check that out. And that's fantastic. I'm sorry I kept you so long, but I'm glad
no
we
worries.
Managed to work it out with the technical parts.
Definitely. It wouldn't have been a recording without them over the internet.
No, they're always going. If you enjoyed this interview, then go to enjoyliveslowly.com/resource for access to other great interviews and articles to slow down and simplify your life. Fabulous opening and closing music is Con Nombre de Tango by Daniel Bautista.